So by the time Brian gets settled, so I will introduce him. So Brian is a very well-known, extremely well-known figure in neuroscience, especially in visual neuroscience. So he is a professor at the University in Stanford, not only in neuroscience actually, but also in engineering and, I think in ophthalmology and four departments at Stanford. So he trained initially, I think, in Michigan and then in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania. His field is not only vision neuroscience, but actually quantitative functional MRI. And so he's well known because of the textbook on the foundations of vision, which is already 20 years old, something like that. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Should fix that thing.
Yeah, it's alongside with John Dowling's book, these are the ones you need to read for knowing everything about neuroscience. And he has been working over the past many years on the functional MRI, quantitative functional MRI, and actually on the time course during development, especially in children with visual impairment or defects. So I think this is exactly the topic we want to cover today. And I'm very pleased that Brian accepted to make the long trip to Paris to participate in this meeting. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Je vous remercie pour m'inviter. It's really nice to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
And nice to have a chance to chat with many of you. I'm going to tell a series of stories for this presentation. There'll be each a little vignette, a little incident, something that I feel I learned something from, a measurement that I feel I learned something about cortical plasticity and visual plasticity in particular. And in many cases, I really will just kind of tell you the story of it and what it felt like to us. The details are all written in papers, and I will also provide throughout the references for the background, and I'll try to tell you as much as I feel you need to know so you have some confidence in the findings. But I won't take you through every step. But on the other hand, all the papers are there, and I'd be thrilled if you looked them up or sent us criticisms or comments and so forth, and that would be great. And the set of stories will all be about the question of stability and plasticity in the human visual pathways. And the focus here will be about the early parts of the cortical pathways, the optic radiation and primary visual cortex, so forth. And the reason that I became particularly interested when José came to Stanford and spoke to us was because the notion of working on the retina, as he does and John does and perhaps others of you, working on the retina and understanding when things go wrong in the retina, what consequence does that have for the rest of the visual system, has long been a fascination for me. And so the story, as it emerges from what I present today, will be a story about how something can go wrong over here and have a consequence over there. And it's a kind of systems view. And I know that that showed up in several of the other talks, but I want to reinforce it here with some kind of concrete examples. Let me say, as I go through this, the goals of the work here, I took a pretty strong stand about 7-8 years ago. I'd gotten, I'll tell you some of the story, but I'd gotten into some, I guess, disputes with Charles Gilbert and Mike Merzenich and various others about to what extent we see general plasticity all across the brain under all circumstances, under all times. And if you live in San Francisco, or I gather from John, if you live in Boston, you're constantly hearing how the brain is plastic, the brain is plastic, we know the brain is plastic everywhere and so forth. And sure, there are parts of the brain that are plastic, and maybe there are parts that are plastic throughout the lifespan. There are also parts that just aren't that plastic. And I see our mission as being learning which parts are very flexible throughout the lifespan, which are not, when these things change from one state to another, and what the mechanisms are for that. And so points across the lifespan for plasticity and stability. I'd like to develop, and this is very important for me, and is to develop methods that work on single individual living humans, one person at a time. And you'll see why as we go forward. And I'm also quite interested in methods that can be automated as opposed to requiring a lot of hand intervention and piecework and analyses. I'm interested in things that can go at scale. Okay, so first let me begin. Does this seem like it's wobbling to you? Maybe. Well, let me know if it gets. Yeah. This is a plastic image. While José is doing what he can to fix this, let me say that one of the things I also want to communicate is how much progress there has been in using tools like magnetic resonance imaging to study the living human brain. And when I was a assistant professor, this was a Nature paper that impressed me a lot. It was a PET paper, came from a distinguished group. Mark Raichel was involved, Dave Van Essen was involved, Steve Peterson was involved. And the Nature paper was a measurement of, they had people fixate and could see a spot of activity in the here's the outline of the human brain over here. And then they moved the stimulus from fixation to a little bit peripheral, and you can see that white spot move from there to there. And they got really excited. They wrote that up as a Nature paper, and they could say they could fill up three good pages about that. And these days, some 25 years later, the technologies have gotten so much better that we can, in an experiment of about 20 minutes, put somebody into an MR scanner. We can segment the gray matter from the white matter. We can measure traveling waves of activity that measure the retinotopic maps and find the several different maps and so forth. And these weren't known in 1990, 1991, and so forth in the living human brain. You definitely couldn't do them in experiments of 20 minutes. And the advances in both MR physics and methods for analyzing the data and visualizing the data have been quite substantial, and I just want to be I want to feel upbeat about it, because there's times I'm feeling, you know, we could be better also. We could be a lot better. And give us another 25 years, maybe we'll be better still. So the early experiments that Steve Engel and Marty Serino and Roger Tutel and Peter Banditini, a number of us, started developing were shown here. And I'll use this idea a lot as we go forward. Here's the right hemisphere of a human brain, and we've segmented out the gray matter from the white matter. And the person is fixated over here in the red spot. And this is sped up. It goes slower than this in an MR experiment. But you're staring over here. And you can see that as the ring expands, there's a traveling wave of activity that runs from the very posterior part of the brain along Calcarin. And this part over here is the Calcarin sulcus. Right in over here, it's Calcarin sulcus. That's where primary visual cortex is. And we didn't have to figure out where primary visual cortex was. That was given to us by the neurologists of the previous generations. But what we could do was make measurements in the living human brain and quantify things such as the eccentricity maps. It seems better. And as this goes forward, I'll say here's Steve Engel and Alex Wade, Bob Dougherty, Lisa Brewer. We all worked on these experiments over the following 10 years from about 92 to 2002 together on this sort of thing. And you can represent this kind of expanding ring, this eccentricity map from the fovea to the periphery here in a static view that where color codes for which part of the visual field from the fovea to about, in this case, it's about 15 to 20 degrees in the periphery over here. And you can see the map in experiment in the living human brain. Now, to see the other dimension of the map, you would use a different stimulus, one that rotates around at different angles like this. And here you can see the red indicates the lower vertical meridian, the green indicates the horizontal meridian, and the blue indicates the upper vertical meridian. And you can see there's a whole hemifield represented over here from the lower to the mid to the upper part of the visual field. And that's the primary visual cortex map, V1. And so that was great. Then you look at the two of these things here. You look at the angle map and you look at the eccentricity representation, and you put them together and you say, ah, there's primary visual cortex, and surrounding it the second V2, second cortex, second visual area, V3, and so forth, the dorsal side over here and the ventral side. And this matches and so we learned this about the human brain and became confident of it in the human brain in the early 90s. And we spent about 10 or 15 years, I want to draw your attention to Kendra Kay, John Winawer, Dougherty, many others. And we summarized the findings about on the order of 20 to 25 maps that you can see that tile the posterior part of the brain running from occipital to temporal and parietal cortex. Okay, now, once we started to get comfortable in the late 1990s, once we started to get comfortable in being able to find these maps and understand sort of the regular behavior, we started to look at cases of potential plasticity, development and developmental plasticity. And one of the things that Heidi Bassler, Tony Moreland, Elisa Brewer, and I became particularly interested in were cases in which people had a genetic defect in which something went wrong in the retina. And the case I'm going to show you now is a genetic abnormality that meant that these folks had only rods in their retina and no cones. So these are called rod monochromats. And there's a particular gene defect that causes a failure in rod transduction. And so there's only rods in these guys. So just to remind you and to get you comfortable with the visualization, I showed you these expanding ring maps over here a moment ago. And sometimes, to make it easier to see, we'll take a piece of cortex like this and we'll computationally cut it out and just flatten it into one big thing so you can see it easily. And the piece right around Calcarin over here, I'll just outline for you. And what you can see here is the same map, red, green, blue, and so forth, running out eccentrically like this, plus or minus 16 degrees. Okay, so that's what it looks like in a typical cone-driven experiment, as I've shown you a few times. And the reason why this one looks red and this one looks green is in the fovea, there's a early onset of the signal, and then it drops off. And in the periphery, the signal is delayed, and it comes up a little bit later in time. Now, if you take a healthy person, and you put them under rod viewing conditions, and so we're not going to excite any cones at all, we're just going to excite the rods. Many of you know that in the very center of your gaze, you have no rods at all. There's zero rods there. It's a rod-free zone in the center of your fovea. And that shows up in the MR scan quite nicely. And Hajikani and Tutel and we and others, you know, it's a thing you do to check that your data makes sense and so forth. We've gone into rod conditions. These happen to be our experiments, and there's no activity presented when you drive things with rod signals. And so the question is, and you can see because of the cortical magnification, even though it's a fairly small piece of the retina, the magnification factor makes it a rather large piece of the cortex that's absolutely missing. We were wondering for people who are rod monochromats, well, what happens? Are they just carrying this piece of cortex around? It's like an extra weight that they take, and it doesn't do anything, or does it get repurposed? And so we could do that experiment, and here is a rod monochromat who came into our lab, and we could measure for them. And there, you can see that, in fact, this corresponding piece of retina is quite active, but it's active. Notice that the color, although here it represents the very center of the gaze, for the rod monochromat, they have no rods in the center, very center of their gaze. So it's picked up, it becomes active, but it's driven by the rods in the periphery. So it all looks green here instead of there being any red over here. So this is a case in which you could easily show with magnetic resonance imaging that there was a congenital developmental effect in which a piece of cortex that normally would have been driven by cones from the by cones in the center, but there were no cones in the center, was now being driven by rods in the periphery. So what I liked about this story was that it showed a kind of, you know, I hang around with a lot of molecular biologists who are always thinking about a gene and what this gene does and how this gene does something locally. And of course, for the gene that breaks the cone signals, you're thinking about cones all the time. But, you know, it has an impact very far away from the cones. It now has an impact at this piece of cortex, and we didn't check many other parts, but at least this piece of cortex is very far away, is now responding in a way that's quite different from the way it would have, even though it's a genetic effect that has an effect on the periphery. So this theme will keep coming up. Now, here's another story, started a few years later, when this fellow here, Mike May, there's a book about him, Mike May, and it's called Crashing Through, and He's one of a set of historical cases starting all the way back from Cheselden in 1727 and Valvo in the 70s and some more recent, of course, Richard Gregory's case in 63 of SB, and then Oliver Sacks followed on 30 years later with his movies about restored sight. But Mike May was a person who also had a kind of miracle cure. And let me tell you the story of Mike. And he happened to have been the first case that happened who we could study after these developments in magnetic resonance imaging. So that although his story was much like the others, he was the first one that came through when we had developed these magnetic resonance techniques. And Mike, as a child, had had one eye just completely destroyed in an explosion in his parents' garage. It was a chemical explosion. One eye is just completely gone. The other eye, the retina, was preserved, but the cornea lens and the limbic stem cells at the edge were completely destroyed, so that he was when he was 3 years old. And as a result, they couldn't do a corneal and lens transplant that would keep clear. And so they tried, but it clouded up right away. And from the age of three until the age of 46, he lived with just the one eye, and it was completely an opaque covering over that eye. So, you know, and as a three-year-old, you all know what three-year-olds are like, they see fine. They can recognize stuff, they're adorable. And they see things, and they're very nice, and so forth. Now, Mike, therefore, at that age, there was nothing wrong with his vision. He could see fine, but he lost one eye, and then the other one became opaque. So over those years, it was like a natural experiment. And you're seeing here a picture of Mike at the moment when, some 43 years later, he was now 46 years old, the surgeries and the stem cell developments had taken place that they could put all this back into his eye and provide him with a clear cornean lens that would be stable. It was a little bit of a risky experiment, but nonetheless, they took care of it and put it in. And here is his eyes being open, and his hand is reaching out to touch his wife's face. He'd been married to this woman for about 15 years, and this is the first time that he opened his eyes and could actually form an image and clearly see her face. Now, you might wonder, what is it that Mike saw? And his case is actually just like all the other cases, like the Cheselden case in 1727, like the Valvo cases, like the SB case of Gregory. He had a good image formed on his retina, but he still really couldn't see very well. And to this day, it's now some 12 years later, he still doesn't see very well. And what happened with Mike is that, well, he could see patterns. He could judge colors almost immediately. He never had very good spatial resolution. In fact, I can show you that here. This axis is spatial frequency. This axis is sensitivity. And you can see that in normal controls at these low spatial frequencies, they can see quite well, and you know it goes on out to about 50 cycles per degree. In Mike, his fall off is at about 2 cycles per degree, and these are measurements made at 5 months, 11 months, 17 months, 21 months after his surgery. And I went back and picked up some data several years later, 84, and it really hadn't moved. And I think Ione Fine has gone back and measured them again. It really hasn't moved; been quite stable over the many, many years that he's had this. His behavior has been stable and so forth. And when you ask him, well, what do things look like when you look, he says, well, you know, when I kind of look at something like this, I can reason about it. I'm getting pretty smart. He's a very smart guy. He's got a high-tech company. And he says, I can look at this, I can look at stuff, and I can kind of reason that must be a computer. But when I walk around to the other side, it all just looks different. And it doesn't hang together, and I have to start the reasoning process all over again. So something like object constancy works so easily for us. For him, it's a thoughtful process where he's just constantly reasoning about what's there. And when you bump into him on the street, I saw him at Davis not long ago, I just happened to bump into him on the street, he still has got his cane, he's got his dog, he's got the whole thing, and he acts, in most cases, like you'd never know that he'd had this surgery. Unlike, by the way, a number of the other cases who became quite depressed about this, Mike was aware that this was likely to be the outcome because of the previous work. He wanted to do it anyway, but he was aware that this wasn't likely to lead to a great outcome. Now, when we started measuring, as we did about almost a decade ago, started measuring activity in his brain, one of the things that we could see is that in this region over here, if we compared a moving stimulus to a static stimulus, you'd get a big old boiling response, and it was really pretty good. And in fact, Mike, throughout, even though he had only this one eye and it was covered, he did a lot of moving. He was a skier. And in fact, Mike had won the gold medal for the Paralympics downhill speed skiing. He skied downhill at 100 kilometers an hour. And he did this by having the actual gold medal from the Olympics ski next to him and tell him, move right, move left, jump, things like this. So he had a lot of flicker and motion and so forth, and MT was retained. But when we made measurements on the ventral side of the occipital cortex, where normally you'd get face responses and object responses and so forth, in Mike, we could never drive a signal, and that's been true to this day. Ione Fine, who's been our collaborator on this, has had him back, and we just can't drive anything out of that piece of cortex to this day. So whatever, we don't really know why things didn't go well with Mike, but I'm going to give you one piece of it. I'm going to move on a little bit and then give you one piece of the story. So I've told you about finding these maps, but what I haven't told you is the next generation of technology that we developed. And John over lunch was telling me that he started out thinking about the retina with center surround, and here's Steve Kuffler and center surround. So there's a really fundamental idea in vision science that you would measure a cell and it would have an excitatory center and an inhibitory surround. And the whole notion of receptive fields is very fundamental. Well, you can measure receptive fields not just for individual cells, but you can measure receptive fields, let's say, for a voxel in a magnetic resonance imaging experiment, an fMRI experiment. And you could do it by basically the same general idea. If you have a stimulus, say, rotating around, and you make a measurement, like the red stuff here would be the observation, you might make a little model that said, well, maybe the receptive field is over here. And if you had the receptive field over here and this thing's spinning around, you'd have a prediction, and you'd see the prediction was this black line there and say, oh, that's not very good. Okay, well, that's a lousy prediction. So how about if we move this thing over and we try it again, say, well, we're getting a little bit closer over here. Still could be a little bit better, right? So let's make it a little bigger. Ah, okay, now I've got a... I've got it back up. Now I've got a different model. If this is too bright, let me know. I've got a different model over here, and I get a good match. And so I've now estimated with a little computation the size and position of the we call them population receptive fields of the from this thing. It's too bright, right? Okay. And I've got one for each hand. Okay, so these population receptive field models, there's a whole bunch of work on this now and that are reviewed in these articles. I promised I'd be telling you about the review articles and so forth. So been reviewed in these articles, and they've been applied quite broadly. I'll be really impressed if Reiner includes population receptive fields in Brain Voyager. Have you? Okay, well, there you go. So now we've actually made it. Okay, that's good. And they've been used in all kinds of measurements of attention, stability, and plasticity, prosopagnosia, development and aging, and so forth. And the thing that you can find is that different parts of visual cortex will have different size receptive fields and differ this much, really quite substantially. It can be very small in primary visual cortex and much bigger in the lateral surface. And if you go within any particular area, let's say V1 over here, it'll rise from near fovea to the periphery. And if you go into MT and motion selective cortex, it'll rise as well. Within each area, it rises, and across areas, it can be quite different. So there's a whole little industry of that. And when we use these methods to study Mike, we notice two things. First off, in normal observers, you've got this foveal representation. This is work from Netta Levine. You've got this foveal representation. We could never really see a strong foveal representation in Mike. And moreover, when we looked at the size as a function of eccentricity of his receptive fields in different visual field maps, whereas in typical observers, they're going up like this, and Mike, they're going the wrong way. They're going down, and they've got a bigger size. So we developed a thought, it's just a thought, that, well, okay, he's 3 years old. The small cells that have small receptive fields are probably the last ones to get really nailed down. The big ones may be first, the small ones maybe a little bit later. And at 3 years old, the small ones might not have gotten really locked down. In which case, when he's just covered his eye so that he no longer had any high-resolution vision, all those small receptive fields just out of there. And so therefore, you don't get the fine detail in the center. You get these big receptive fields and so forth. And that may, and if those are principally the ones that feed object recognition, that leads to a problem as well. So it's just a theory. But I feel like we've got at least something to work with based on the magnetic resonance imaging. Okay, here's another case, another story. And this one comes from Sergio Milan, when he was in my lab, and we ended up striking up an arrangement with Michael Hoffman, shown there on the right, because we'd made similar measurements. And this is one which also will show a kind of plasticity, and I find this one particularly remarkable. So many of you know that the structure of the, in the human visual system, the right visual field ends up sending its information to the left hemisphere, contralateral, and the left visual field ends up sending its information to the right hemisphere. And this is arranged by the nature of the projections, how the optic nerve comes out. The nasal side crosses at the chiasm over here, the optic chiasm, and then joins up, and that's how you get half the field on one side and the other half the field on the other side. It's true in humans, not true in all species. And this is just another drawing of it, the nasal field coming over here, and some citations in case you want to go check my logic on this. And in MR, you can see the chiasm. It's not hard. Yeah, in a normal person, you can see it. And one day, this guy shows up in the clinic, Joyce Liao and Nancy Fishbein find a guy. And this guy's chiasm looks like, oh, no chiasm. Okay, so that's weird. And the guy came in because he had nystagmus. And he had various other disorders, by the way, midline disorders, a syndrome called Bacterial. But he had no chiasm. And they said, would you put this guy in a scanner and measure his functional responses? And, you know, you all have a model of what you think this guy's functional responses should be. It should be the case that this eye drives this hemisphere, and this eye drives this hemisphere because there's no crossing there. There's no way for the signals to go merge back and forth and go over there, right? That's what he's supposed to look like. And sure enough, if you cover one eye over here and you put stuff in this hemifield, the right hemisphere responds. And if you put stuff in the other hemifield, the right hemisphere still responds. So what we did to try to quantify what's going on is we ran one of these population receptive field experiments, and we looked, this is a typical voxel, we looked in this voxel to see, well, here's the points are the time series that we measured, this is how things varied over time, and this filled line is the best we could do if we tried to fit a little model, as I showed to you, of here's the center and here's the size of this population receptive field of this guy. And you can see that we did a really crummy job. That was really no good. And what Serge noticed was that if we just used a slightly more complex model, where we said, you know, we've got something over here, and symmetrically on the other side of the vertical midline, as if the signals from the two retinas come up over here, but then fold over so that the nasal side folds over onto the temporal side, comes up here, we do a great job fitting the data. And so that was interesting. And here's this guy, which I find remarkable, that here's somebody whose cortex is completely wrong by the standards of everybody in this room. And yet, you know, his nystagmus actually resolved, and the guy was out there playing baseball. He reads just fine. He can judge the depth of things. He doesn't have stereo, but all kinds of other stuff is fine. And yet his cortex is completely differently wired from the rest of us. And somebody, it might have been Stephen, said during his talk, you know, like cortex is a learning machine. And here we have a case where stuff is coming in that's completely wrong into primary visual cortex, and the rest of cortex somehow or other figures it out. So even though there's a certain stability in certain places and other places, it's quite flexible and quite capable of dealing with it. Serge, I just saw this there. Serge told me this was coming out, and I just saw it the other day, and I thought I would mention to you that he and, I don't know, his buddies in Utrecht dug up this. This patient had been known for a while. This was a patient who had half of their brain simply didn't form at the time that they were at the time of birth. But the person, I'm sorry, you can't see these notes. But the very center over here is 10 degrees. So this person sees on the left eye and the right eye a lot of the visual field. Sees out to about 40 degrees in the visual field. And if you're missing one hemisphere, if one of my hemispheres goes, I'm not seeing that hemifield. But this person, who started with only one hemisphere, and so the signals from the eyes went up into that hemisphere, sees a lot of it. And it's the same story with this hemihydroencephalic person, that this person's data are well fit by this bilateral PRF model as opposed to the one with a single one. And the person has problems. I'm not saying that this person is completely normal in all regards, but the person sees reasonably well, has some hemiplegia, doesn't work really well, but I mean, it's missing a half a brain, so it's really quite remarkable he can do anything at all. I should say that this particular model had been noted and suggested kind of a little bit earlier than we had by Jonathan Victor and some others, but they hadn't really been able to measure it. The only big improvement we had was we were able to measure it. But there's another model floating around, Lars Muckley and your boy Wolf and so forth, have this other notion that what happens in these cases is that there's multiple little embedded maps. And I'm sorry, but we don't see that. We don't see any hint of that. But it's possible that there are different ways that people respond under different cases. So if you all collect up data of that sort, share them with us. We'd like to be able to compare these different cases. Okay, so despite the profoundly disrupted V1 maps, the rest of the brain figures out what to do, and I think that's amazing, personally. Okay, so we summarized some of this and what I'm about to tell you next in a paper, in a Nature Reviews piece. Particularly, I did that one with Stelios. But this followed on a set of experiments that we did in collaboration with Nikos Logothetis and a series of just wonderful ophthalmologists who came to my lab from Tokyo and studied each, about four of them, got PhDs with me over the years, and we did a series of experiments, and I'm going to tell you about that. I won't tell you about the work I did specifically with Nikos and Stelios, but I will tell you about the human. That was a monkey work, and it was invasive, and ask me about that later, because I still have a lot to work out emotionally about that. Okay, but here's a thing. There had been this whole thing going around, starting really with Mike Merzenich and John Koss and Charlie Gilbert and so forth, that there's a lot of plasticity following retinal lesions and retinal disease in V1. There's just a lot of plasticity, they had asserted. And it got a lot of attention. And when Nikos and I got started, we thought, yeah, okay, we're going to sort of study that in certain ways with MR and with pharmacological interventions in monkeys and so forth. Anyway, it didn't work out very well. And what instead we found was very little, shockingly little. And so we wrote that up. And then I thought, we don't really need to do these in monkeys. We can do these, the human stuff is getting good enough. And we could do it in the cases of people who had things like age-related macular degeneration, or in this particular case, juvenile macular degeneration. And what we found in the human cases was matched what we also found in the animal studies. Here's a person who has, and the outside is where it's white, they can see, and where it's shaded dark, they can't see. People develop what's called a preferred retinal locus, a place, a kind of a go-to place on the retina where they use to fixate in that case. And we could put a stimulus around that region over there. And when we did, now you're not getting a response out of here because the retina, there's no retina there to provide a response. But you might ask whether the cortical response around the PRL here would spread all over cortex. And we could do that in this person who's a JMD subject, a JMD patient. And then we could do it in a control case like this, put it in the same place. And you can see they're just not that different. And this stressed us a little bit. We were expecting to see, you know, more plasticity and more spreading and V1 and so forth. And where was that? And there had been some claims in the literature that they could see that. And we struggled with this for a couple of years. So we kind of sat on this, and, you know, why are we different? And we finally did an experiment, Yuichiro did an experiment, where instead of just having the subject passively look, the subject was engaged in a visual one back task. So that means you show them something, and then you show them the next thing, and you say, well, is this thing I'm showing you now the same as what you just saw, or is it a different thing? So one back. Is it the same as the thing you saw one back, or is it new? And, you know, when you do that to a control, the activity goes up a little bit. So here, you just compare, I'll flip back and forth. It gets a little bit bigger, but doesn't really move anywhere. But when you do it with the JMD, it spreads further, and it gets way bigger down here. In fact, this is the biggest thing. I mean, down here on the ventral surface, never mind V1, but down here in these object recognition areas, this thing's just sort of singing. And the responses, these are just showing the responses over here as you go from the PRL on back. And so we could get a little bit of spreading, but it would be task-driven. And it wasn't particularly driven by, it wasn't just as though V1 had entirely reorganized. It was something about the signals that were driven by the task would make that happen. And the same thing was true, by the way, we subsequently, with Yuichiro and Hiroshi, we also went and looked at RP subjects, and that seemed interesting. I know there's some interest in RP here specifically. And here, this guy has tunnel vision. You could see over here at about 5 degrees. The periphery is blind. When he looked passively, red means there was activity. Blue means it was slightly inhibited. Dashed line means that's where the calcarine is. It's a little hard to see. This is the right hemisphere, the left hemisphere. When you do the one back task, all the stuff that's deprived of a feed-forward projection does respond in the JMD. There's no effect. Nothing shows up there in the controls. So what we learned from that is that in passive viewing, nothing had changed, and that kind of made us think that if we were to tell a story about it, that the feed-forward projections from the lateral geniculate nucleus into here probably hadn't changed very much. But there's all kinds of projections that come into V1, not just the feed forward from the lateral geniculate. There's the extra striate feedback. Stuff comes in from the pulvinar. I mean, it's a whole system over there. And our thinking is that when this primary signal over here is removed because of a retinal lesion, when there's no signal, we actually think of that as not being no signal, but being, no, that's a value of zero. I'm not telling you that, I don't know. I'm telling you, that's zero. It's a different thing. Is that okay? Different thing. It's not that there's no signal. When the cells are intact there, it's telling you there's zero contrast. And when you remove them, it says, I don't know what the hell the contrast is. Those are two very different things. So in the presence of zero contrast, the extra striate feedback, you know, oh, I'm looking for things, or whatever comes up from the pulvinar, might be very different compared to the case of, no, it's zero contrast, because I told you it's zero contrast. That is a different situation. And so therefore, the signals might be different. Now, that's not really an argument for plasticity. We've just removed one of the major inputs, and the system behaves differently. So you can call it plasticity if you like, as some of my colleagues insist, but I don't know if I would do that. I'd say I'd like to have a model of the way this thing works, just like I have a PRF model, I've got a traveling wave model, I got models, right? And here I'd like to have another model, a slightly more complex model, and this model really needs to be more complex. The simple population receptive field linear filtering model, too simple for cases like this. You need to have switches, circuits, stuff like that, or else you're never going to be able to get phenomena like this. So that's something that's really important for us. I continue to do a lot of work on reading, and I have exactly the same need for these models in the case of reading as well. Okay, so next bit, and by the way, one of you earlier said, was saying, oh, I don't know, plasticity, people bug me when I call it plasticity or don't call it plasticity. And I have a lot of sympathy for that. I might be one of the people who do the bugging, actually. But it seems to me that we get past it once we start writing models down. And we try to say, well, here's how I predict the signal. And when I change the input or I change the feedback or I change something about the circuit, this is what I expect the response to be. And I think that's the direction. If I get 25 more years, not too damn likely, but if I get 25 more years, that's the direction that I'll be pushing. Okay, last bit is the use of MR in a rather different way, and it'll be my last set of stories. And this is work, this is Shunpei Ogawa and Hiromasa Takamura, who also joined from Japan, and actually a lot, I could have listed a lot of other people, Jason Yateman, Franco Pastilli, others worked with me on this. And over the last 12, 14 years or so in my lab, we've spent a lot of time and energy on thinking about the connections between different parts of cortex, not just the signals in cortex itself and the models, but what can we say about the connections between different parts using technology of diffusion-weighted magnetic resonance imaging. And in fact, again, John and I, we covered a lot of territory at lunch today. And one of the people who really got me thinking about this was Ben Barris, because he's so focused on glial cells, and glial cells, oligodendrocytes are the things that wrap the axons. And you know, when you think of these connections as being axons that are wrapped by glial cells, you right away think, well, you know, this isn't like a piece of copper wire. This is something that's alive. It's cells, and these cells grow. And oligodendrocytes have oligodendrocyte precursor cells that either grow or don't grow, and they respond to the environment. They respond to activity. They respond to all kinds of things. So in the case of the human brain, when you see this white matter, although you can pick up Eric Kandel's book, and Eric will say, white matter, well, it just sort of hangs out around there and keeps the brain from collapsing on itself. The more modern version is to say, no, the white matter, it's like biology. It's alive. It does stuff. It grows. It changes in response to activity. It's important for development and so forth. So active wires, that's the theme I'm pushing here. And I'm sorry, but I'm not going to tell you. I want to just alert you. I'm not explaining to you how it is diffusion MRI works. I would love to explain it to you. Not going to happen right now, sorry, but it's a wonderful technology. And then how tractography works on top of it. But I did just complete an annual review paper with my best understanding of both the measurements and the tractography and so forth. And so this is me advertising that. And by the way, that field takes a lot of guff from people. It's one of those fields where I've noticed that my pals who are electrophysiologists or anatomists say, oh, that tractography, and they all kind of nod knowingly at one another. That sucks. That's no good. But actually, it's a very good field. And I'm sticking with my story, and if you invite me back sometime, I will tell you why, what we can do with it. And one of the things we can do is, never mind tract discovery, we can go and measure the properties of tracts that we know that are there. So Jose is a clinician, and if somebody comes into your office and they can see well, do you think that they have an optic radiation? He said, yes, excellent diagnosis, I agree. And so we're not discovering that they have an optic radiation, but we're using the method to identify where is the optic radiation. So, okay, that's good. So it's something we can check its health, its size, its curvature, things like that. And you can do this in a living human brain without hurting anybody, without taking it apart. You can measure its tissue properties. So it opens up a possibility for lots of things, like in cases of amblyopia, for lots of things that you might not otherwise have looked at. So this is what you can measure quite easily and regularly from the chiasm to the LGN, that's the purple, and from the LGN, here's Meyer's loop and back to primary visual cortex over here, and you can do these in experiments that used to take about 20 minutes, and now we can do in about 8 minutes because MR physicists just get better all the time. And you can measure what we call tract profiles. This is a piece of work, open source software from Jason Yateman and so forth. The tract profiles, meaning some measure of tissue property. Here I'm showing one famous one called fractional anisotropy from the chiasm to the LGN, from the LGN all the way back to here. This is in this one person in a 10-minute experiment. You can automatically find these tracts, and you can measure the fractional anisotropy as you go from here to all the way to the back, you can measure this in lots of people. And let's say, let's take the mean of it along the middle of the track. So I can point a measure a single curve, and that's what's shown here, the mean along the optic track, and here's the mean along the optic radiations go from the LGN back. And I can do this for 100 people. In fact, I have about 5,000 of these measurements in my in our system back at home, and people are always adding more. And the black curve is from the LGN to V1, from the LGN to V1, that's the black curve. The distribution is shown here in shaded gray up and down over here, two plus or minus two standard deviations. So it's like you've got a baseline. And now you can take somebody who has some type of retinal dysfunction, and what Shumpei Ogawa did was collect up a set of patients who had Leber's hereditary optic neuropathy, a retinal ganglion cell disease. And somebody asked earlier, is it a ganglion cell disease or a cone disease or a rod disease and so forth? So this is a ganglion cell disease. And here's this particular individual, and you can see that at this location, this person is off the distribution. So something's wrong with this person's optic radiation following this retinal ganglion cell disease. And we had, I don't know, about 8 or 10 of them, seven, I forget, some number. And some are actually within the distribution, and some are off the distribution. So it's one at a time. And obviously I like this because you can see why it would matter in the clinic. You'd want to know, for this person, is this person on or off the distribution? And I could have averaged them all together and put a little error bar around it and said, you know, Leber's in general is off the distribution. But actually, I want to know whether this Leber's patient is on or off the distribution. And that was one of the goals of almost all of these things. You can also do it for, do the same thing for people with other diseases. These are people with cone rod dystrophy. It's a different disease. And the story is, you know, similar. Though, look at this particular guy here. Man, that particular subject is just spot on the mean. So you might want to treat each one of them differently when you prescribe, or people you might consider for different clinical trials for prostheses, you might choose one or the other. So, you might decide to use this guy rather than any of these guys for a prosthetic implant. So that's really the last little bit of the story. You can see that retinal dysfunction has consequences for both V1 activity and function and for these white matter pathways that are carrying the signals. So we're trying to think of the thing as a whole pathway. We're trying to think of the axons, the oligodendrocytes, the functional responses, how it fits in the circuits, and so forth. And these are retinal diseases, so they're pretty far away. Or retinal or genetic defects of the that lead to retinal dysfunction, but we're measuring things all the way in cortex and in the white matter. And to make this go well, we really as a community need to collect up baselines in a quantified way, so that if I run somebody at Stanford and Reiner runs somebody in Maastricht and José runs somebody here in Paris, we can share the data, we can share the quantified standards. When Amir does somebody in Jerusalem or Rehovot, he also has to have these standards and so forth. And they need to be the same across different clinical instruments, different 3T, and so forth. And so that's another part of the mission that we're on, to kind of build a shared infrastructure where scientists around the world can cooperate. And let me say that, as you can tell, as I've been going through this story, I didn't do this work on my own. I've just been unbelievably lucky. They don't pay us very much at Stanford, but we get these really good people coming by to work with us. So it's a fantastic form of reimbursement. And these are the folks whose work I was describing as we went through. And I want to thank the NIH, the NSF, Simons, Weston Havens, and Wallenberg and Arnold Foundations for help at various times over the last 25 years as we did this work. Thank you for your attention.